Okay, guys, here we are. Wednesday, April 13th. Anybody have anything immediate to bring up? I have something I think we might get to, but let's hear if anybody else has got something.
Well, I got a new post out today, part two of my blog series on McLuhan's synthesis.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. Where is that? What is this, Clinton? Is this something you've been working on a long time?
Yeah, well, I did installment one last week. I did part two this week. I'm going to keep going. I'm just going to try to pound out my thoughts on analogical proportionality and logos and all the shit that people don't get to begin approaching to understand McLuhan. I'm just going to make a blog series until it's fucking done. And then, those write-ups will serve as the fodder for me to then ad-lib and point to on more casual forums. So I say, I already wrote about this shit. Go to my damn blog and read it. I already spelled it out for you, dumb fucks, right? That's the sort of...
So listen to this, Glenn.
You know,
last night I had an idea, or just an insight. I said, holy cow, the word tactility, as McLuhan uses it, which is not any sense, it's the interplay of sensory interaction. It's the organizer of the brain and the five sensory inputs, or four, however sensory inputs are. I suddenly realized tactility is equal to the word virtuality, because virtuality is sort of this unreal, weird, nowhere zone. That is what the mind is, as defined by tactility. So we can read McLuhan when he's using tactility, he's saying virtual.
Wow, that's a powerful substitution.
Yeah.
Worth exploring. Interesting.
That's interesting. That's good. That would ground the idea of the virtual in continuity with our, you know, our first nature inheritance or whatever. Like, it's our giving it some continuity with our raw experience, I guess, or the idea that the virtual is the extension of the original capacity that allows us to be detached enough to have a thought about reality or something like that?
Yeah, like, the mind is nebulous. We don't know what the mind is, ultimately. It's sort of part of our physicality, but it's not. But isn't that what virtual reality... Was virtual reality just the electric? No. What was it?
Okay, here. Let's, I just opened up Pierre Levy's late 90s book, Becoming Virtual, and let's see if we can put the word tactile into it wherever he uses the word virtual.
Right.
Let's reverse it here. The word virtual is derived from the medieval Latin virtualis, itself derived from virtus, meaning strength or power. Okay, so now I'll substitute tactile for the rest of it. In scholastic philosophy, the tactile is that which has potential rather than actual existence. The tactile tends toward actualization without undergoing any form of effective or formal concretization. The tree is...
Oh, hold it, Clinton. Isn't that what your mind is? You're always thinking a thought, and then you get a thought. You resolve something. It's almost physical, but it isn't. But you think you got somewheres. You know, it's very interestingly nebulous, same as virtual.
The tree is tactilely present in the seed. Strictly speaking, the tactile should not be compared with the real, but the actual. For tactility and actuality are merely two different ways of being. Here I'd like to...
The tactile is all time, no time. So that's the actual. That's the potential, includes potential, you know, all times.
Here,
Ion's always talking about capacity in us, or potential. So
potential,
what you
potency.
Just, and aren't we all, don't people think, when they're thinking, they think someday they're going to get somewheres where it'll be real solid. And how do I know? You know what I mean? It's a carrot in front of the stick or something, right? But you do, it is physical because you can hear your thoughts. It's so nebulous. The Vedanta Buddhists or whatever they are, I think they call that your true self. I think that's what they mean. The thing that's aware and thinking and never gets, like, if you die, you still could be thinking. So you still got a mind, so to speak.
Right. So it's like dualistic, I suppose, is the term.
Yeah, it's naturally dualistic, but it's not, well, my whole understanding of that is that you start writing, then you make duality a problem, you know? And you start getting stuck in the writing, and then specifically the phonetic alphabet. But people, before writing, they're called tactile. But they're very flexible, and they have, quote, psychic experiences, supposedly, compared to the literate guy, who's got all bogged down with a split mind, because he visualized it. That's what I how I interpret myself when I talk about the mind and tactility and the psychic. So, but with virtuality, what do they think they're making at NASA or wherever they're making this stuff? They're trying to, we talked about fuzzy logic last week. They're trying to figure out how to make the mind fucking physical, right?
Right.
And so they're working in the tactile, and no one knows if they're going to get there. We don't know if AI arrived. Now, Ian says it has arrived as a tech body, but for most people, it's almost like the mind. We're never going to get there. If you really watch your mind doesn't conclude on anything. It can make conclusions, but that'll get you in trouble. But it's just, I with this insight, I recognize all that I understand is tactility is virtual. You know, I'll use that. I'll say, and if you read McLuhan, you know, it's funny how no one got the tactile part of McLuhan when they were reading him, unless they really read it closely. They kept thinking we were acoustic, but we had retrieved acoustic space. No, we got tactility. Electricity's tactile. But it was so, in Take Today, they use the word intangible. Many intangibles. This is the virtuality, this is tactility. It's intangible.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, when you say non-physical, that's kind of what you're getting at, too.
Yeah, it's non-physical, but it's here. It's still, it's so, Hendiades, one by means of two, or.
Yeah.
It's Jordan.
And this is Aristotle's principle of potential, or potency. Like, the ancient meaning of the word potency, to be potent, or to be impotent, is to lack potential, right? Impotency, right?
And then education is trying to get people, get their mind going, so they get potential, incarnate. And it's always nebulous because you almost can't get a person to activate their mind. They have to stumble on an understanding of it in relation to what's all been written about it. Like, I know when I first read McLuhan, I didn't know what tactility was. I didn't even know it was there. Then one day, after a couple of years, I saw, oh, tactility. I thought it was touch. Everybody thinks it's touch contact, right? What I would call kinetic pressure. Everybody thinks tactile is the actual contact. Then I saw, holy shit, it's not a sense. It's not contact. And then maybe Barry Nevitt told me, yeah, Bob, it's when you touch your fingers. It's the space between your fingers when you're not touching. And then you get rhythm when you're touching the on, off, touch, not touch, touch. So I saw what tactility was. And then I would try to tell other people, and they'd be puzzled until they got it. You know what I mean?
I like to think of it as when you wake up in the middle of the night in your bedroom, and it's pitch black, and you're walking around, and like you sense you're coming close to the door because you're familiar with your own bedroom, but you can't see it.
Yeah.
And it's the sensation of approaching an object in the pitch black dark and reaching out for it, and knowing you're going to touch it, right?
Yes, but once you touch it, it's kinetic. So that integral space where you're using your sensory memories to know where you are, I think that space of emptiness is tactility, but you're starting to fill in sensory aspect by saying, oh, I know I'm getting near the door because I got visualized images. But
I know it, it's that I feel it, right? Or, you know.
No, that's hard to tell if you feel it. You might say that. But let's say you're in a place in the dark, you don't know where it is, never been there. that's, you've got to be real careful, right? You're going to bump into something and you don't even know it's going to be there. Unless you've got ESP, so to speak, and can see in the dark. But, you know, this nebulosity is the essence of the communication problem between humans. Because if you develop your tactile in some weird way, where you can see in the dark or something, that makes you different from other people. And then they don't believe you if you told them, but you might be able to demonstrate it. So we've always been exploring this weird virtual space. That's the big issue. And if people don't understand that, you can't figure it out. You can't articulate the doubleness. You just know it's there. Like you say, I know I'm thinking. I'm thinking that I know I'm thinking. That's as far as you can go with it. It's when people start to say, what's going on? This is what's happening. That's when you screw up other people. Because they think you've got somewheres. And then eventually they say, no, you didn't get anywheres. Relax on that. I'm not going to hear that anymore.
Right. That's kind of so the equivalent that's like the equivalent of touching something. You're like, oh, I got it. Or that exact thing. And it's like, well, no. Unless you let go of it, then you lost the tactile.
Yeah, if you touch somebody impolitely or when it's not understood, that upsets people, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're very sensitive on the touch thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, some cultures, you know, you see the Japanese squeezing into their subways. They're not that worried about touch in that sense. But you see that in New York or someplace. People, they have a space bubble, which McClune used to, I think using Ed Hall, we had a space bubble once we had visuality. You know what I mean? We visualized our three dimensions more than non-visualizing people. So, what you were just saying, so yeah, touch, that's the sense of communis. That's the thing that everybody is equal on about, hey, don't fucking touch me, right? Or, yeah, you can touch me, I like you, you know? That's the beginning of knowing another person, so to speak. How much the touch can be allowed.
Yeah, definitely. That's like how we measure that, kind of.
Yeah, that's what was interesting about Ed Hall's book. It was called The Silent Language. He said that Arabs, they had to be less than 8 inches from your face to feel that they were connected to you. Whereas Westerners, they didn't. That was too close, you know. Yeah. Hey, buddy. You got bad breath, move back, you know, or no bad breath, but the intimacy of interspatial getting closeness is different in cultures. Mm-hmm. So the common thing is the level of tactile approachness, intimacy, or actual physical kinetic pressure.
Yeah, and it was the, I remember bringing up Edward Hall 2 years ago when it was the initial, you know, the initial attack of social distancing, and suddenly people were no longer comfortable being, you know, the amount of comfortable distance that people just naturally sorted into in a, like, you know, okay, line up at the register. You know, they didn't used to tell people how far apart to line up. People just picked. People just settled into the distance that's, you know, not too close for comfort, but not too far to be weird, like, why are you so far away, right? There was some sweet spot that we all intuitively got. And then it got made really
too far away, Brian, if you were too far away, the line would be too long.
Or someone will just cut in front of you and be like, oh, I didn't know you were in the line. You're too far behind that person. Then that's, they created that situation when you're waiting 6 feet behind them. It's like, wait, is this... harder, it became harder to gauge the line. And,
I never experienced that part of COVID because I didn't go any place. Carolyn did the shopping, she would go. I never experienced it, but I imagine, because I eventually saw news clips of little things drawn on the ground that people had to stand in, you know, drawn. Probably because it was getting too ridiculous for people to really know what to do, so they made the distance, they made the spots on the floor. But I didn't experience any of that, but it must have been ridiculously awkward first couple of weeks, right?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
But that's a good example of fucking with the tactility. She said, oh, don't use your tactility. It can be 6 feet. And that's it. 6 feet, nothing less. You know, that screwed up people's natural tactility, which was negotiating the interval. So that's interesting.
Right.
What do you say, Clint?
Yeah, we were trained. No, you want me to speak about fucking standing 6 feet apart or not? We were trained to police people about where to stand in our store and to try to get an empathetic feeling when someone might be standing too close to someone else and walk over like, hey, can you guys, like, you know, you're getting real close to that lady, buddy. She doesn't even see you behind her. Can you back off a little bit, please? We're only allowing four people in the store because it's so small. Like,
you had to do that, Clint?
Yes. We went around and telling you, like, yeah, it's like I might as well have had, like, a fucking stick to poke him with. I might as well have.
So what I was going to say, when you thought I was interrupting, Clinton, is what we're saying right now, had you thought about this? I mean, are we talking a new topic here?
Concretely, I knew that people were going to be trained to experience all sort of weird spatial violations and that they would not have otherwise kept. Listen, like, 3 years ago, our store was a crowd of mess of people all staying next to each other, throwing their shit on the counter, breathing on each other, in line. There was 30 people in our cramped store stinking up the place with their body heat, everyone's talking and yelling and shit. And now, we still have a max of 7 people. It's wide, open, airy, breezy. We make everyone sort their shit outside, on the counter outside. There's, like, garbage blowing across the fucking parking lot because everyone's letting their... We're not gonna have that hot, musty fucking room of people shoulder to shoulder anymore for a long time to come. I know that much.
What I was interrupting you for, I wanted to ask you, what I really meant was, the way we're thinking about it the last 10 minutes, have you ever thought of tactility the way we're thinking about it before?
Right, no, I didn't quite take those observations and construe them all the way to this level. Absolutely not. It's a novel way to think about it.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, what did you think tactility was?
As I said, the, sort of like the center, it's sort of like, the interplay of the senses, which if they get too concrete, you actually end up with synesthesia, right? When you become conscious of your tactility, right? That's the way it,
you going to synesthesia is putting more sensory content in. You've got to go to the void.
Right, well, that's it. Where you're not aware of the way in which you're different senses are integrated into a whole, in that hence you have tactility. If you are in touch with that, that's synesthesia, and that's aberrance. That is sensory.
Well, it's
you
a visualization. Right.
Yes.
And
if I smell colors, is that a visualization?
Yeah, it's mixed up, but you got visualization in there. But listen to this, Glenn. If people, you know, Aboriginals don't have any access to writing or anything, they would not have an issue about what, they wouldn't know what tactility was, because they wouldn't have sensory descriptions. I mean, probably, I don't know what Aboriginals said about their sensory life. Let's say they didn't say much, because no one could fucking lock it down by saying, writing it, and then saying, this is what it is. That might happen in the shaman classes. Maybe that's what shamans originally did. They got these people, who didn't care where they were, to start focusing where they were and develop some problems in their thinking about it, and then they had to resolve it. I said that cavemen, meaning primitive people, really Aboriginal, they didn't know when they died. Isn't that interesting? They, you know what I mean? They shifted somewhere else, and they didn't know they'd shifted.
It's the premise to an M. Night Shyamalan film as well.
Yeah. And so without visualization, they didn't know they shifted. They might have felt something different, but maybe not. But they didn't know they died.
This was also the subject of a novel by that weirdo in the 1940s. What's his name? Hold on. I'll be right back. I'm going to figure it out.
Weirdo in the 40s, eh?
Science fiction? Some science fiction guy?
Yeah, hold on.
Not Korzybski.
Stanislaw Lem?
Oh, no, it's one of these playwright dudes who everyone analyzes as one.
Oh, Pirandello or Artaud or Ionesco, one of the absurdists?
The third policeman. Yeah, who wrote...
Flann O'Brien.
Flann O'Brien, yes.
Nice.
I never heard of him. Who?
What? You never heard of Flann O'Brien?
Yeah, I'm talking about Flann O'Brien.
Oh, he's good.
Is that an Irish guy?
Oh, yeah.
He's got a bunch of different names.
His name
was actually Brian O'Nolan, but his pen name was Flann O'Brien, Miles Negacopoline, John James Doe, George Noel, Brother Barnabas, and other untraceable pseudonyms under which he's public.
A lot of those names are in Finnegan's Wake. I know those names in Finnegan's Wake.
Well, he
had this wonderful character that he created named DeSelby, who shows up in more than one of his books, who is like one of the great like Dobbs Quadrant characters of all time, I'd say. And he's sort of like someone who, I don't know, like Robert Anton Wilson wrote something about, like, imagine if J.R. Bob Dobbs met DeSelby and someone else or something. Like, yeah, he's like this mad scientist character.
I never heard of him. So what did he do? He wrote books and he was known?
He wrote kind of absurdist books full of pataphysical situations and out of, like, it's the same vein of discarnate weirdo-ness of modernism that...
Or Alfred Jarry, the Jarry guy, J-A-R-R-Y.
Sure, yeah, it's a modernist, you know, absurdist novelist guy who's kind of insane, yeah. Proto Philip K. Dick, maybe, you want to put it that way.
How would you guys have heard of him? In school?
No, remember I was trying to get you to read Andrew Gottschalk's book, Modernism and the Machinery of Madness, where he studies Wyndham Lewis and all those dudes. It's in there for me. I'm not sure how Brian stumbled across Flann.
So you just discovered him lately, last couple of years?
Yes.
Yeah.
The boring way, through...
How'd you know about him, Brian?
I think I first... heard of from Robert Anton Wilson, like I've heard his name DeSelby as a character, but Robert Anton Wilson probably presented it as if there is this author named DeSelby out there who's written all these. In Wilson's historical Illuminatus trilogy, he went nuts with footnotes on the second volume of that, where it's like it becomes absurd, where like the footnotes, you know, kind of start taking over, and it's all about this idea that, you know, he'll say some historical claim and then a footnote, well, this claim has been disputed by this person who said that it was actually this other conspiracy, but then this other author says that that author is part of that initial conspiracy. And DeSelby weighed in on controversy, saying blah 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 in his book Doo Doo Doo, but Wilson was like making shit up. Yeah, he was just putting his own words into DeSelby's mouth and just using the you know, satirically or whatever, using the format of the footnote to just as like a hoax to just convince people that like, oh well, there must be this very fascinating author named DeSelby out there who just haven't found his books yet or something, and then you go looking for them and you can't find them because it's a hoax and you just got pranked. But you know, it's a fun device he uses there. So that's where I would have first heard of DeSelby. I'm not sure where I first got tipped off to where DeSelby came from and how to actually read the books that Flann O'Brien wrote, where he's a character, but I know that I read the book The Dalkey Archive that features this DeSelby character back in 2009. So that's when I finally read DeSelby.
Mm. Okay, so I'm looking up Flann O'Brien. I've never seen that image. Never seen that guy. Brian O'Nolan. Better known by his pen name, Flann O'Brien. I never heard of him. That's amazing. He's a key figure. So Joyce plays with Bruno Nolan and all these variations, but he wouldn't know about this guy because he was born too late for Joyce. You know? He wouldn't have written until after World War II.
All right, just one paragraph just to give you an idea. Andrew Gatke writes, O'Brien's career renews the Irish satirical tradition of Sterne, Swift, and Joyce that rewrites the novel as counter-encyclopedia, a literary form well-suited for checking the ambitious projects of knowledge production, organization, and legitimation that have been the purported engines of modernity. If, as Bruno Latour has argued, modernity announces itself as a work of purification by which rational inquiry is cleansed of irrational belief, O'Brien's novels suggest that the belief in the possibility of such purification is the deluded work of fools and madmen. As you have seen, such resistance to ontological confusion and contamination structures the delusions of many paranoid psychotics. Their self-narratives are attempts to restore failing distinctions between the human and inhuman, the self and the other, the meaningful and the meaningless, even at the cost of persecution, anxiety, and delusions of grandeur. O'Brien's satirical project stages attempts and failures to redraw such ontological distinctions. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so.
Okay, Clinton, another thing, Clinton. You begin your synthesis, McLuhan's synthesis, about analogical proportionality. Now they have a new understanding, supposedly, of tactility. That's what you're trying to write. And you're going to have to rewrite that whole thing. Because you didn't get this tactile virtual thing.
Oh, right, right, right. Well, this is why I'm writing it.
That's
up for review and consideration.
Yeah.
All right.
No,
right.
I suggest that's why you're over-talkative of it. You don't get it.
I don't get it. Okay.
And to say tactility is virtual, I don't think anybody would agree with me unless you sat them down and then they got to hear what I mean by tactility, quoting McLuhan, the interplay. And maybe they'd say, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, we'd be interested.
Okay, well, talking about the breakdown between distinctions of objective reality and subjectivity or delusional thinking, potential.
Those are two literary categories you just laid out.
Right. Well, the breakdown thereof is what we're discussing. So, yes, it doesn't matter, literary, because we've broken them down, right? So,
yeah.
If you want to talk about...
we've got to the...
the potency of tactility. If you want to talk about the potency of tactility, a seed has within it virtually the tree it may become, right? And then that's where you get those weirdos like the Gaia guy, Lovelock or whatever, Lovelace, have
Lovelock,
right? The morphogenetic field. He's trying to literally instantiate the potency, the potential of the tree, right, as a characteristic of the seed.
Yeah, you see, that's it's to be. If you're looking at tactility and you get it, then you start talking about potency. Then you're trying to visualize it. You've got to accept the nebulosity of the mind, and you can imagine, visualize that I have access to all knowledge. So then you meet a bunch of people, give you exercises on how to tap in, become aware of it all. But I think you always have to remember that you're not going to get the tactile, and then that relaxes you, and then you do fucking. Something happens to you, but the tactility is always there, the way the Vedanta people say, your eternity, your nothingness, but you're aware of it, is always, and all the metaphysics around that, like when Ayn says there's no time, that's what he's talking about, tactility. So how long can you live in this nebulous thing? Without interacting with people, it's pretty hard. So once you interact with people, they're going to bring a sensory bias into it. Just by dealing with them, they're getting you to focus your tactility.
Yeah.
And make it non-tactile. Can you remain non-tactile, remain tactile with no sensory translation, like the monks do when they go live in a cave for 20 years? And then they watch their sensory life get filled in they call hallucinations and that, and visions, or they're going through the chakras, you know, all that a yogi would go through. That's your tactility, which you can't stop its making process. But you don't know what's doing that making. You can't, Alan Watts used to say this, you can't touch the thing that does the touching. You can't see the thing that does the seeing.
If we think about all the invisible forces around us that we can be made to feel, like if you feel a countertop is dirty and you feel the salmonella, or you feel that the 5G waves are giving you a headache, or you feel the person next to you who's coughing is going to give you a horrible disease, right? You can't. Your senses are not directly putting you in touch with that, and yet you're inculcating a tactile sense of what's beyond your immediate sensory thing. That's sort
you're,
of related,
you're not
right?
inculcating tactility. You're beginning to translate the void into something. Gradations of sensitivity or gradations of actuality, of quote physicality. And so you deal that with a baby. A baby comes in tactile, and then you start fucking with it. And it starts agreeing with what's massaging it. And then it becomes focused. And then, you know, by the time it's 4 or 5, it goes to school and it gets focused more. And it starts to lose either the understanding or the naturalness of the void that they came in pure with. So then they take kids who go live with animals, grown, raised by animals, right? They're being affected. So communication is the problem in consciousness, because you start interacting with something, with your environment, and then you have to negotiate that. So you know how McLuhan says that we're all the I Ching says you're always adjusting. That is an ongoing thing, is adjustment. And politically, I was explaining to me once that Mel the Evergreens told me this, that Kennedy made a deal with the Chicago Mafia, and they rigged the voting in Mayor Daley's place. And that beat Nixon by a very small amount of votes. And everybody knows historically now that happened, and Nixon should have won without the Mafia interference. But then the Evergreen said that Kennedy then got into the White House with his brother, and the New York Mafia was more powerful than the Chicago Mafia. So they had to adjust to the deals already with the New York Mafia. This got the Chicago Mafia pissed off, and that's why you had the wars in the late 60s, 70s, 80s of Mafia guys getting killed, New York guys getting killed. The Chicago guys went against the New York guys because Kennedy fucked it up. And remember, his father was, Joseph Kennedy was involved with the Mafia too. So I use that as a sociological, it's an idea that Kennedy, involved with power, had to adjust. And that's what goes on in power. So you see, McLuhan says that modern electric power is full of alliances and misalliances, is what he says somewhere in Understanding Media. That is a constant adjustment sociologically of communication between people, which is the concrete collective manifestation of the adjustments you make when you're living and so, modulating your tactility.
So in Typhon in America, McLuhan points out that Superman doesn't have any superpowers that we don't already have. Crane, like if you're a millionaire and you hire a crane operator to build a massive building, or you get in an airplane, you can fly over a building if you want. You can lift steel beams. You can redirect trains. Humans through our what he would later say extensions have superpowers already, and so Superman, the Clark Kent Superman psychology is just a commentary on what a regular rich guy with power feels every day, just because he can do all those things whenever the fuck he wants.
That's quite fascinating. Superman then is a vision of the sort of ultimate user-friendly technology, you know, that like, right, like the rich person or whatever, they technically have the ability to do something approximating that, but they would have to, you know, get on the phone and call someone and say, hey, you know, I'll pay you if you do this, right? Yep, and then get it done, but it has to wait till the next day or the next week or do. So it's the idea that you can do it instantly at the push of a button, or not even the push of a button, but just with a thought, right? That you can, these powers, you can do,